Welcome to Poetry Lectures, a series of lectures by poets, scholars, and educators presented by PoetryFoundation.org. In this program, Mark Scroggins discusses the poet Louis Zukovsky. Mark Scroggins teaches literature and creative writing at Florida Atlantic University. He has published one collection of poetry and has written extensively on a wide range of modernist and contemporary poets. His primary interest has been the American poet Louis Zukovsky, and he spent 8 years writing The Poem of a Life, a biography of Louis Zukovsky, published in 2007. Zukovsky is best known for his book-length poem, A, which he worked on for most of his life. In this lecture, Scroggins discusses Zukovsky's development as a poet in the early 20th century, and in particular his sense of Jewish identity in the context of anti-Semitism among other poets and intellectuals of his time. Here's Mark Scroggins speaking at the Spertus Institute for Jewish Studies in Chicago on June 1st, 2008.
I'm here to talk to you this afternoon for a little while about Louis Zukovsky, a writer who you may or may not have heard about, but whom I consider terrifically, terrifically important and interesting, and interesting enough that I've spent, I guess, like 2 decades now working on him. And that work has culminated in this book, The Poem of a Life, which is a full-dress critical biography. Zukovsky wrote a lot of things. He wrote a number of collections of short poems. He wrote a gigantic and very eccentric critical study of Shakespeare. He wrote essays, he wrote fiction, he wrote a play, he wrote some very important translations. But his major work is this book, which is this very, very long poem called simply A. And he himself called this The Poem of a Life, or A Poem of a Life, which is where I get the title of my biography. Now, I really love Zukovsky's poetry, okay? And I'll end up probably reading you some bits today. And it's the love of his poetry that led me to write about him. I'm not one of these academics who is sort of looking for the main chance and seeing where I can advance myself, who I ought to write about next. I wrote about Zukovsky because I love the work. And a central element in the work is the fact that Zukovsky was Jewish, right? Now, we hear a lot about famous and important Jewish American prose writers, right? Say, Philip Roth, or Saul Bellow, or Cynthia Ozick, or Harold Bloom. We don't hear so much about American Jewish poets, particularly modernist poets of the kind of pre-World War II generation. And that it's not just a matter that Jewish poets were kind of thin on the ground before World War II, though that is true. As a lot of people have argued, within the modernist movement in literature, there's a kind of covert and sometimes overt anti-Semitism at work. And one of the most interesting things about Zukovsky's career is the way he dealt with that, the way he negotiated that, and the way he came to find his way to an identity as a specifically Jewish modernist poetry. Now, it was right here in Chicago, back in 1912, almost 100 years ago, that Harriet Monroe founded the journal Poetry. Poetry, a magazine of verse. And Poetry did more than any other magazine to introduce American readers to modernist poetry, to this familiar set of names, right? T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, Wallace Stevens, William Carlos Williams, Marianne Moore. Not a Jew among them, you'll note. Now, in 1923, the New York writers Jakob Gladstein, A. Lyellis, and N.B. Minkoff, These are a group of Yiddish writers who had started a movement of Yiddish modernism that they called themselves the Inzichists, the introspectivists. And they'd started a journal. They called it In Sich. And they sent a copy to Poetry Magazine. And they got a letter in response. I'll quote, thank you very much for your magazine. Unfortunately, we cannot read your journal. We would like to know what language it is printed in. Is it Chinese? Now, one way of assessing that would be to say that, well, Chicago is not Manhattan, or maybe Harriet Monroe didn't get out enough or get to the right neighborhood. She couldn't tell what her Chinese laundry wrote on the bill from a Yiddish newspaper. But there was one poet publishing in Poetry and following the modernists that Poetry published who would have been able to read In Sich. And that was Louis Zukofsky. Zukofsky was born on the Lower East Side in Manhattan in 1904. His parents were Jews from what then was, golly, take your choice, Russia, Lithuania, Belarus now. He was the first and only member of his family to be born in the United States. Later in life, he would recall the coincidence that the year he was born, 1904, was the same year that Henry James, the American novelist who'd spent the last third of the 19th century in England, came back, visited America, visited Manhattan. In fact, Henry James visited the Lower East Side. And who knows, might have cast eye upon the infant Zukofsky. This coincidence, Zukofsky said, it appeals to me as a forecast of the first generation American infusion into 20th century literature. Now, I, for one, find it hard to imagine a contrast more radical than between Henry James and the Zukofskys on Christie Street. Right? On the one hand, you have this fastidious, hypersensitive novelist who rarely writes about households that have fewer than five or six servants. Right? On the other hand, you have this apartment full of hardscrabble Orthodox Jewish immigrants who are doing their darndest to escape the shtetl and everything that smacks of the shtetl, and who are doing it the handiest way possible, which, as we all know, is the garment industry. And Louis's father, Pincus, who, of course, came over alone, saved up the money, brought the rest of the family. Pincus worked in a sweatshop. He was a pants presser. This is the worst job you can have in a sweatshop. We're talking curvature of the spine and so forth. He worked a shift as a pants presser, and then he was the night watchman. Right, so he probably worked 18-hour days. Louis, of course, is the baby of the family, the new world child, the repository of who knows what kind of hopes and dreams that his parents have. And for him, the way out of the sweatshop, obviously, is education, culture. And he loved to talk about his education, formal and informal. He loved to tell how he went to see, when he was a small child, even before he started school, he went to see Shakespeare and Ibsen and Strindberg and Aeschylus at the Yiddish theater, right? All in Yiddish. His big brother took him. Or how at the age of 11, 5 years after starting school, he took up the teacher's challenge. The teacher challenged every kid in the class to read all the way through Shakespeare. And at 11, Zukofsky read all the way through Shakespeare. in English. He was kind of disappointed that his prize was a book called The Boy Electrician. Now, somewhere along the way, Louis failed to acquire or lost, I would say failed to acquire his parents' faith. And this is something that never actually seemed to trouble him much. However, the fact that he wasn't Orthodox or that he wasn't a believer at all didn't mean that he stopped being a Jew, particularly in the eyes of the culture that he was trying to insert himself, that is, Western culture, European-American high culture, literature, philosophy. Maybe his first big culture shock was when he went to college. Columbia University, in fact. He had just turned 16, by the way. You could do that back in 1920. Now, most New York Jews who went to higher education, of course, went to City College. City College was free. City College was actually predominantly Jewish at this time. Columbia, on the other hand, was expensive. His parents had to sacrifice, and he lived at home. And Columbia was trying hard, with mixed success, to keep the Jews out. Right? They were Ivy League. They were being taken over by highly competent, ambitious Jewish students. So there was kind of a tension on the campus there. Zukovsky was at Columbia for 4 years, and he acquired a number of things. He made some fast friends of people who would later be famous: Meyer Shapiro, the art critic; Clifton Fadiman; Mark Van Doren, who was his professor; Whitaker Chambers. He was best friends with Whitaker Chambers, who, of all things, named Zukovsky as a character reference during the Alger Hiss trials, which is a bit of a funny episode. Zukovsky got a very solid education in philosophy and literature. He found a substitute, an ideological substitute, maybe a spiritual substitute for the religion he had never gotten. That substitute was revolutionary Marxism, right? And he was one of the first generations of students to go through what would come to be known as the Great Books curriculum, which was founded and established at Columbia just a few years before he started. It was started by John Erskine, who was one of his professors, who he would remember in later years with very, very mixed emotions. The idea, of course, is for students to spend a significant part of their time at college collectively reading through the great texts from the history of Western civilization. And you don't read the books as historical artifacts. You read them as living thoughts, as things that can have relevance to your life as it is now. But once again, if you look at the great books lists from Zukovsky's time there, and frankly from now, it is a remarkably Gentile list. That's to say, outside of the Hebrew Bible, or rather, as they call it, the Old Testament, Spinoza, and, well, shall we call the New Testament a Jewish document? At the time when Zukovsky was doing great books, they were not reading Marx or Freud, right? So aside from those two texts, the Old Testament and Spinoza, it's an entirely Gentile reading list. And the impression it gives is that culture, Western culture, is a non-Jewish thing. Flatly. Now, Zukovsky was 22 when he wrote his first important poem. He was 2 years out of Columbia, and this is 1926. It's a 330-line poem called "Poem beginning the, or possibly poem beginning the. Yeah. It's a kind of manifesto. It's a statement of purpose by a young poet who wants to flex his muscles, who wants to show what he can do, but at the same time who feels himself hemmed in on every side, well, certainly hemmed in by the poetic tradition to which he aspires to be a part. The most immediate formal model for poem beginning the, or the, is a poem that was published 4 years earlier. That's T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, or The Wasteland. Now, Zukofsky was well aware, as many people didn't seem to notice at the time, that Eliot was something of an anti-Semite. Okay, and what kind of an anti-Semite or to what degree can be argued, but if you followed his poetry as Zukofsky did, you realize that the movement that Eliot was representative of may not be a comfortable place for a Jew. So in a poem called Burbank with a Baedeker, Bleistein with a cigar, Eliot writes about an American Jewish tourist in Venice. He says, "But this or such was Bleistein's way, a saggy bending of the knees and elbows with the palms turned out, Chicago Semite Viennese." Or a little bit later in his poem, Gerontian, towards the opening, Eliot writes, "My house is a decayed house, and the Jew, lowercase j, and the Jew squats on the windowsill, the owner, spawned in some estaminet of Antwerp, blistered in Brussels, patched and peeled in London." Now, poem beginning the, it's closely related to The Wasteland. In fact, it's an answer to Eliot. But it doesn't really answer him on the basis of his anti-Semitism so much as the basis of his cultural pessimism. As when the Wasteland came out in 1922, everybody read it as a poem about the end of the West, the decline of the West in the aftermath of the First World War. Western culture, it seems to argue, has reached this impasse. And the only way we have to go is either down into some sort of an abyss, and we can see this abyss yawning in Russia and Eastern Europe, or we can hope for some sort of miraculous deliverance. Not so, Zukofsky says in his own poem. There is hope out there. There are fresh sprouts in Western culture. For one thing, Zukofsky in no way sees what's happening in Bolshevik Russia as an abyss, right? Much of the poem beginning the, is addressed to his mother directly. And Zukofsky writes, "It is your Russia that is free, mother." And on the other hand, there is new life in culture, in places that T.S. Eliot would not think to look. Now, you're all probably familiar with The Wasteland, of course, and you realize that the poem is practically a heap of quotations woven together in various ways. It's like Western culture has become this stack of scraps and shards that Eliot is vainly trying to fit together. As he says, "These fragments I have shored against my ruins." Well, Zukofsky's poem beginning the is also a collage of quotations. So he quotes Chaucer and Dante and Sophocles and Horace and Herrick. But he adds into the mix two figures Eliot never would have touched. And one of them is the German Jewish poet Heinrich Heine, right? Who's this wonderful anomaly, right? He's absolutely central to the German romantic literary tradition. but he's also Jewish. It's very hard to deal with this for various elements of Western culture, German culture. And the other figure is a poet called Jehoash. And Jehoash is the pen name of Solomon Bloomgarden. Bloomgarden was born in 1870, is a New York Yiddish poet and translator, a terrifically interesting and important literary figure. Not merely does he write sort of strikingly almost modernist, proto-modernist poetry in Yiddish, he also translates into Yiddish. In fact, he translates the Hebrew Bible into Yiddish, which becomes a standard text. He translates all sorts of things. He translates Longfellow's Hiawatha into Yiddish. And the young Zhukovsky, this is the first book Zhukovsky recalls reading, it's Hiawatha. Right? And he remembers reciting Hiawatha in Yiddish to crowds of Italian bullies back in his old neighborhood. He says, I would quote a few lines and they would throw me pennies. So Jehoash's work as it's presented in Zhukovsky's early poetry, and he quotes him at length in poem beginning the, and he quotes him in the early movements of his long poem A, is an emblem of this new, vibrant culture that's coming directly out of cultural hybridity and out of a Jewish source. Now, poem beginning the presents Zhukovsky as a poet between worlds. On the one hand, this high culture of the modernists, which rejects Jewishness. On the other hand, his father's Orthodox tradition, which rejects high culture and literature, particularly in English. Zhukovsky feels betwixt and between. He says he himself feels like Spinoza. The Jewish figure he can most identify with is Spinoza, the 17th century philosopher who, on the one hand, gets excommunicated from the Amsterdam synagogue, and on the other hand, gets shunned by all the Christians as an atheist. You can't win. So Zhukovsky says he finds himself in the end as a double agent. He is Shylock. In fact, you remember how at the end of his most famous speech in The Merchant of Venice, Shylock says, the villainy you Christians teach me I will execute, and it shall go hard with you, for I'll better the instruction. Well, Zhukovsky writes, assimilation is not hard, and once the faith's askew, I might as well look Shagat's just as much as Jew. I'll read their Donne, John Donne, as mine, and leopard in their spots. I'll do what says their Coleridge, twist red-hot pokers into knots. The villainy they teach me I will execute, and it shall go hard with them, for I'll better the instruction, having learned, so to speak, in their colleges. Now, the poem beginning the or the is published in 1928 in a little magazine called The Exile. And it's edited by, of all people, Ezra Pound, the expatriate American poet who would later become known, of course, for his fiery anti-Semitism. Pound is probably the most important literary friendship in Zhukovsky's life, which is, of course, very interesting. Now, Pound's anti-Semitism begins in his youth as this kind of suburban prejudice. Jews are not the people you associate with. As his mental disorders get worse and worse, one might say, as he becomes more unhinged, he becomes convinced that mostly Jewish financiers are behind the world wars, that Jewish interests are behind the whole decay of Western civilization since the Renaissance. And you can see him becoming more and more intransigent in these kind of beliefs over the course of his correspondence with Zhukovsky, which is pretty heavy for about 12 years. And Zhukovsky was Pound's protege. Pound published him and encouraged him and put him in touch with his friends. And in turn, Zukosky almost worshipped Pound's poetry, at least. Now, their correspondence, I must say, is a fascinating and extraordinarily uncomfortable set of documents, because they are continually battering heads. Zukosky is a Marxist. Pound is a fascist or an adherent of some kind of crazy conservative economic program. Zukosky is Jewish. Pound is anti-Semitic. Even though he likes to say, look, one of my best friends is a Jew. And sometimes in the early letters, in fact, Zukosky plays along with this anti-Semitism, which is a measure of his own estrangement from the Orthodox community. At one point he says, the only good Jew I know is my father. A coincidence. The Menorah Review, which would become the Partisan Review later, and which is edited by Zukosky's college buddies, he calls them a Sanhedrin that refused to publish his work. But as Pound's anti-Semitism gets more and more wacky, Zukosky finds it harder and harder to stomach, though he'll never quite break off the correspondence. Now, when Pound is arrested and brought to the U.S. at the end of World War II for trial, for treason, for having made broadcasts on behalf of Mussolini's government, Zukosky's asked for a public statement. What do you have to say on the case of Ezra Pound? And he says, I never felt the least trace of anti-Semitism in his presence. Nothing he ever said to me made me feel the embarrassment I've always felt for the goy in whom a residue of antagonism to Jew remains. I would point out how disingenuous this is. In his presence, nothing he ever said. Zukosky and Pound met only twice before the war and spoke on only two occasions, right? There's plenty of anti-Semitism in the letters, but he doesn't want to publicly condemn him. The worst he'll say against Pound is, he may be condemned or forgiven. Biographers of the future may find his character as charming a subject as that of Aaron Burr. It will matter very little against his finest work, overshadowed in his lifetime by the hell of Belsen, which he overlooked. You know, one gets the sense that Zukosky doesn't really come to terms with himself as a Jewish poet, or as a Jewish modernist, until he's in his mid-40s, until 1950 or so, when his father Pincus has died, and he's commemorating him in the 12th section of his long poem A, reflecting on Pincus's long life. And here's where I'd like to read a couple of passages, because I find these passages tremendously moving. For instance, Sabbath, the pious carry no money, make no purchases. They have everything from Friday, the eve of the Sabbath. Rest, a long Sabbath. His father, my grandfather, Maisha Afroim, the Sephardim, speak differently, faced east in the synagogue, ebon hair. On the eve of Sabbath, at the end of Sabbath, at home, so good his singing voice, sing bridegroom to bride, Sabbath has gone. Neighbors stopped at his windows, leaned on the sills. Here he writes about his father's work. Moses released the horse for one day from his harness so that a man might keep pace. A shop bench his bed. He rose, rested at 4, half the free night, befriended the mice, singing psalms as they listened. A day's meal, a slice of bread, and an apple. The evenings, what matter? His boots shone, gone and out of fashion. His beard you stroked, Paul. Paul is Zukovsky's son. His beard you stroked, Paul, with the Sabbath Prince Albert. I never saw more beautiful fingers used to lift bootstraps. A beard that won over a jeering Italian who wanted to pluck it with the love his dark brown eyes always found in others. Everybody loves Reb Pincus because he loves everybody. How many strangers, he knew so many, said that to me. Every Sabbath, he took me, I was a small boy, to the bird store window to see the blue and yellow poly, the cardinal, the orchard oriole. Everybody loved Reb Pincus because he loved everybody. Simple. And finally, they named their son, Zukovsky and his wife named their son Paul, which was actually Pincus's English name as well. And this was caused some scandal in the household. Naming little Paul for him, almost 90, I knew Pincus would not mind their English names being the same. He might have said, to reprove me, Jews remember the dead in time, are in no hurry to flatter the living. He never reproved me. Let it be Paul. I know Ivanovich, named for Ivan, before he is born. Still, our Hebrew names are not the same. Bless him. May he live 120 years. And the end is the same. Bach remembers his own name. Had he asked me to say Kaddish, I believe I would have said it for him. How fathom his will, who had taught himself to be simple? Everything should be as simple as it can be, says Einstein, but not simpler. Now, after the war, after the death of his father, there comes a new sense of kind of self-conscious Jewishness to Zukovsky's poetry, a sense both of his own continuity with a very ancient, a very rich Jewish tradition, and a sense that wherever he may be, that is, whether he's traveling in Europe, whether he's traveling across the country, the United States, whether he's at home in his beloved New York City, and he is nothing if not a New York poet, wherever he is in exile, or as he puts it, in Egypt. He writes, I look out from my Brooklyn Heights window, and I see the structures of Egypt. Now, how to define Zukovsky's Jewish modernism? I've wrestled with this a while and probably come up with various, which seem to me kind of unacceptable definitions. I mean, in some sense, his poetry is modernist American poetry with a Jewish inflection. I want to say more than that, but I'm not sure I can. I happened upon a wonderful comment in passing some months ago from the critic David Kaufman, who writes for The Forward occasionally, writing about Zukovsky, the Jewishness of Zukovsky's poetry. And he says, let's say there is a specifically Jewish modernism, and that it sounds a little different from its non-Jewish counterpart. Its tutelary spirit is Heine, and its cardinal points are aggression and comedy, which I find aplenty in Zukovsky's work. Aggression and comedy, in contrast to these other modernist poets who tend to, often are quite aggressive, but who tend not to be very funny. But this is Kaufman again. But as comedy is frequently nothing more than socially sanctioned aggression, we might add sentimentality. Sentimentality shading, in fact, into kitsch. Right? So aggression, comedy, sentimentality. Those last passages I read you, which frankly I find very moving, may also be read as rather sentimental. And there are, of course, many passages in Zhukovsky's work which nobody will take for anything but kitsch. Not many, but some. I don't want to sell him short. There's one longish passage, longish, I mean a page and a half, of A, in which he enumerates the tchotchkes he and his wife Celia have accumulated on their hearth. Lots of ceramic horses. And I would add, maybe a little more seriously than Kaufman, I think Zhukovsky is a Jewish modernist as well for incorporating specifically Jewish motifs, specifically Jewish materials and sources into a collage poetics as pioneered by the other modernists. And he does this increasingly over the course of his writing life. I would add that I think Zhukovsky's a Jewish modernist in his relation to the book. The Jews are famously the people of the book. Zhukovsky is the poet of the book. And that's not to say he's bookish, though he can be a little bookish, but in that he sees making poetry as an act of doing something that has been done before. Whenever you write a poem, you're rewriting a poem. You are actually doing a midrash on somebody else's poem that you may not even know, that you may not even have read. His favorite emblem of the poet is the horse. That's why the tchotchkes are ceramic horses, right? And he writes in that same section of A, he says, the horse sees he is repeating all known cultures and suspects repeating others unknown to him. Maybe he had better not think of himself hunting, so to speak, sewing, so to speak, composing always, composing, recomposing, replowing a field that's already been plowed. And in this, it seems to me that Zhukovsky's whole conception of the poet's task differs from what is conventional within Western Gentile culture. The whole notion of inspiration, which for me has always smacked of, on the one hand, the incarnation, the notion of something numinous, something divine making itself visible at one place in one time, or the day of Pentecost, where all the apostles are sort of seized by the Holy Spirit. Rather, for Zhukovsky, poetry is a path to follow, something you do day in and day out, something that does not depend upon this kind of descent of the Spirit to be breathed into you. It's a very halachic notion of what the poet does. And I'll wind up with just a brief, funny, and enigmatic quotation, which nobody else knows because it was relayed to me firsthand from the person who witnessed it. Which is that in 1963, I believe, 64, sorry, Zhukovsky's visiting a writer friend in Lexington, Kentucky. and they're out taking a walk, and they walk past the Beth El Synagogue. And apropos of nothing, Zukofsky looks at the synagogue and says, "Well, I guess I'm a Chinese Presbyterian Jew." And I've thought about that a long time, right? He's Chinese because he loves this kind of concision, this kind of musicality in his poetry. He's Presbyterian, I suppose, because he's a bit of a Puritan. He's got this uncompromising edge to his work. But you notice that Jew comes at the end, and Jew is the noun that all of the weird adjectives modify, right? And that's because that's what he was, however you define it. Okay. Well, thank you.
That was Mark Scroggins speaking at the Spertus Institute for Jewish Studies in Chicago on June 1st, 2008. Mark Scroggins' book, The Poem of a Life, a biography of Louis Zukofsky, was published in 2007. You can read an essay about Louis Zukofsky at poetryfoundation.org. You'll also find many other articles about poetry, an online archive of more than 7,000 poems, and audio programs to download. This has been Poetry Lectures from poetryfoundation.org.